So I'd like to really explore how the Dharma looks at love and at sex. And I think I'd start with the understanding that there's two great powers that work on a person. And one power is the power of fear, of survival, of separation. So the child separates itself from everything in order to survive, in order to be an independent being, an individual, a self, has to look after itself, has to learn to separate from the mother, from the life, from biologically, from everything. So there's a withdrawal process based fundamentally on fear, on survival. And that withdrawal is very natural from all beings. Every being needs to sort of say, there's my boundary, that I have to look after. I need to know where my boundary is, I need to look after that boundary that I'm not destroyed and dissolved again into the world. So it's part of being a being, a being, a big B. And the other movement is the opposite one, which is our natural connection with life, our love to belong, to be part of, to join, to be overcome separation, which is painful because it reminds us of survival all the time. Separation is always reminding us of survival, and it has in it this fear. And truth is, we were never really separate, ever, and we are not separate. But this withdrawal into a being with boundary and looking after myself and my interest, my world, me, and this body, is a construction and a split that we make. And it's very much clear in love relationships. And I like the image that I learned from Rachel about in the Kabbalah. The image is in the Kabbalistic language is Nesira. Nesira, it's called. There's books and books and books written on this. Namely, man and woman were joined, were one being. And then along came Nesira and cut them. So, but the original state is joined. And the cut happens, and then there's separation, and then man and woman have to find each other again. And it's not so easy. And there's also the legends, mythology, Eros and Psyche, the Greek mythology of they were together, then they split because they saw each other. Never mind the legend. And then they spent the whole, then they had to find each other again through the whole, all the different worlds of existence. And then they finally found each other. So there's this sense of splitting as being part of survival and then rejoining to what we never left each other really, but it's a kind of a construction. So in the Dharma, love is is the Brahma Viharas. And I sent you Christopher's article because he talks about it very beautifully. And quite rightly so, he says basically that metta is love. And love in the biggest sense. And it's Brahma Vihara because it is something divine. It is Mashu Kadosh, Mashu Elohi. Why is it Elohi? Because love can never be cut. It can never be measured. It cannot be controlled. It joins everything together and not split things into pieces. And it's timeless. You can't have love in time. Love is doesn't have time in it. And so all these are qualities of the divine. They are qualities of not the human being, the single human being that made a boundary and is trying to survive in life. So this is divine qualities. It's a huge power, a huge energy, a huge vitality, love. And it energizes everything we do. Love is huge energy. And I remember, you know, when I fell in love, sort of, while young, many times, and the energy was just overwhelming. I remember one night, I was in Oxford as a student, and my girlfriend was meant to come from the other side of England by hitchhiking through the night. And it was the middle of winter, and there was snow up to here, and I was not sure how she'd manage, when she'd come. And I remember I stood in the snow the whole night, from about 8 o'clock in the evening until 5 or 6 o'clock in the next morning. I didn't go home. I stood in the snow under a tree, waiting for her to arrive with it. And that for me is the image of this power of love. It's so, so strong. And the whole thing, we charge ourselves a lot of... Christopher was describing how it charges his teaching and it charges his creativity. And he's non-stop creative teacher. He writes books after books after books and non-stop. He gets up early in the morning and writes a book, you know, through the day. And he runs all over the world and teaches. And it's the love that gives power. And we can all feel that the love gives us huge power. And it empowers us because it's connecting us to everything. We all join together. We join the world, therefore we get the power of the world in us. This is why it's divine. They get the God power in us because it's beyond the human construction of separation, of withdrawal, nasiga. It's joining, and so we get the power of the world coming through us, flows through us. And Christopher and other teachers, such as John Peacock, who has some beautiful talks about this. And John Peacock is a somewhat academic Buddhist, but nevertheless a deep practitioner. And he was some years in the Burmese and Eastern tradition. And then at a certain point, his teacher said, you have to spend 1 year doing metta practice. Just shift totally from citta to metta. And he spent a year on 3 months on each of the four Brahma Viharas. Metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy, and upekkha, equanimity, or steadiness. And then he writes, so he talks about that we really need to get beyond the idea of metta as loving kindness, or the idea of metta as a practice which we need to do to create love. That because love is so, we need to shift our view of what is metta into this vibrational view that it's love. It is not a technique for creating loving kindness, which is kind of a concept and a certain direction, and rather a slice of love. And I'll talk about this in a minute when we talk about the practice of developing love. I'm going to talk about it, but just to be aware that it's a lot bigger than the way we usually describe as metta. And it is, and the Buddha taught it as a vibration. And he never ever taught any method of developing metta. He just said, vibrate with love. because there's no method which you can have to develop. So, according to the Buddha, it's something universal, something divine, and when we experience it during the day, we experience it as something universal, and you can call it universal friendliness. So that if we are connected with the world, when we get up in the morning, we feel connected with ourselves. We go out and outside, we feel connected with the trees and the plants and the people. We go out into the street, and it doesn't matter where, or the city, or Khalil, or whatever. We look with kindness at everybody. Everybody is their own lives. Everybody is expressing their life. Everybody is being what they are. And there's no against. And there's no resistance. And we're just for the world. Whoever it is, the dog that passes by, the flower that's trying to struggle through the concrete, beton, the efforts people are making to make this life better, the suffering of people as we pass them by and we see their struggles, that's all metta, that's non-stop. So that flow, it's not something that you can really design or practice in a very limited way. So, of course, because love is this universal truth which is in which we're all connected, and the fear and the separation is something constructed based on survival, as much as we reduce fear and negativity and resistance, then the love will grow by itself. So the two are connected. And the love we have for each other, two human beings, that is romantic love, or love of a parent and a child, or family or friends, or even belonging to a group that feel very warm to each other or whatever. These are, if you like, models of divine love. They're like divine love expressed within a framework that makes it possible. And so there's a model. And in this model, say in romantic love, we are drawn to each other. Two people drawn to each other, they express something universal in that love, romantic love. The whole of the love of the world is expressed in these two people loving each other. And what has happened is, for these two people, the resistance, the fear, and the separation have been dropped. And then what happens is this magnet of love. Love was there, love is there everywhere. In a divine Brahma Vihara's way, we're in love with everybody. Everybody is our lover. We are loving everybody and everything, because we never were separate. But because of the withdrawal, it doesn't quite work like that. And we need to have metta vimuti, we need to have liberation of love for that to happen. But we can look, it's useful to look at love between people in the misgeret of model of romantic relationship, for example, as expressing something universal. There it's possible. So you love this person because of a small trigger. I remember also when I was like 18, I went to America, and I was traveling around America, and I sort of landed in California, And but on the way, I passed through. I was hitchhiking over through America, around America, and on the way, I went to Denver, and in Denver, I found myself at a party, and there I met a girl, and nothing happened, but she was wearing a perfume, a certain scent, a kind of perfume, bossin, of a certain smell. That perfume never left me for like 6 months afterwards. I had it in my consciousness. And this girl was, for me, became an angel. And it was all because of, I think, this, the scent she was wearing. The mind is crazy, you know. But if we ask ourselves how we met our partners, it's in Bamikre. We didn't have the whole, all people displayed like in the internet, you know, we have 1,000 people and we choose, and even if we did, we would choose them to be what, Zeh or Ozen or Loide or something crazy or some memory we have somewhere for something we say, ah. It has no sense to it, this whole thing. It's all the Mikriyut, and then we fall in love. And it just shows us that it's love that's just given the space to happen, rather than we sit there designing the ideal love. It's just things that happen to us, and then love is released. It was there in the beginning. It's just released. I used to read at the university this author called Konrad Lorenz, and he was a biologist. I was in the science world, and I really liked some of the things he said. He was studying love in animals. And of course he showed how animals have love, and the beautiful stories of how animals cry when their partners are killed, and birds and geese and so on, when they live all their life with a partner, and how they cry. They cry in a different way, but he showed how they cry. But he showed that, and it's interesting, that all the rituals that exist in the animal world to do with mating, like the dance of the birds and the song of birds and the color, the tail of the peacock and the movements, the dance of deer or you know, whatever, Ayalot, how they do ritual movements, otherwise they'd kill each other. That all the ritual is to release love beyond the fear, to stop the fear. The ritual is like a game to undo the fear, and then love appears. And when you think, we do the same. We have our rituals. For me, this scent of this girl that I hardly spoke to, but she was with me in my consciousness 6 months. I didn't speak to her, but it was the scent of her perfume was enough to kind of ritual to overcome everything and release love. And we have humans tons of rituals of this kind. I mean, millions of rituals we do for this, to release our love and to overcome resistance and overcome fear. And it can be anything. It can be music, it can be dance, it can be language, it can be the right pub, it can be the right clothes, it can be the right perfumes, it can be the right style, it can be the Nike shoes, or it can be the, I don't know what, a million possible things, products, and the right car. And one sentence comes to mind that from a woman, an English woman, who was after rich men. She said, "I would never have a relationship with anyone that turned right when you get into a plane. They have to turn left," meaning Esakimba, Machlaka Rishona. It was just a sentence. I thought, I don't know how I remember it, but it's like, ritual, you know, I will only have somebody that turns left when they get into a place, into the Makhlakar Rishona. The personal love is heavily mixed. It's where the universal love is heavily mixed with ego, with needs, with desires and with fears. And as much as we can reduce that, then the love flows. And usually with strangers we just don't have that. We don't reduce it. So that the ego and the strangeness and the distance is there, and we don't have the ritual to overcome that, so we allow it to happen. And so our relationship with most strangers is based on something constructed, a distance which isn't real but is part of our life. And so the effort, for our effort is all the time to go from the conditioned love to the unconditioned. Is all the time to see love closed by conditions and undo the conditions to expand the love so that love grows. And then we find more joy and more richness in our life. So the first number one way of doing this is of course seeing, is knowing, is deep knowing. Because deep knowing can be the bulldozer that kind of cuts the path for love. When we know, it actually overcomes our distance. Knowing itself is connecting. So in romantic love or in our spiritual practice, knowing, namely awareness, makes a path for love, because knowing is connecting. So if we see somebody, our first reaction would be stranger. That's the resistance, that's the fear, that's the conditioned survival mind. Stranger, maybe even harmful person, because can hurt me, but at least I don't need this person. That's the resistance. Seeing this other person who is a stranger, seeing their eyes, seeing their nature, seeing their being, seeing their thoughts and feelings, seeing how they build their life, seeing where they're coming from, that connection makes a path for love. You will start to love that person. Even the difficult person, there will be love there because of the seeing. Like in the Bible, seeing and ladat in the Bible is used for seeing and sexual relation at the same time. Knowing and loving is the same word in the Bible. And in the Dharma practice, we are all the time emphasizing in intimacy and closeness, and transforming the moment of experience from distance to closeness. That is basic Dharma practice. We're always there in that place, on the edge of our experience, getting close to everything, inner and outer. That's Dharma practice. And if we practice it with our partner, it just creates the pathway for love. So if our partner is difficult, arguing with us, has a different view, doesn't respect us, always irritated or angry, whatever, if we respond by seeing, something is melted in that moment. We see behind the story. We see the pain of the other person. We see the why this person is doing this. We see the other person's nature. We see their need for protection. We see their need or their neediness. What it is that they're afraid of. What it is that they're saying through this moment of anger or irritation. And immediately you can see, well, of course, there's no reason to be angry back, to be the Haganah to you, to join this anger. Because the seeing again makes love. You can love the person in the middle of their shouting, in the middle of their anger or their irritation or their outspanment, because of the seeing. You can see the seeing transforms every moment and allows love just to flow. And sometimes we need to see the pain of separation. And this is quite important. If we ourselves want to develop metta, loving kindness and big love, we need to see where it's stopping. What's the block? For example, we're in love with somebody and then we see them talking to another person, having coffee with another person of the opposite sex in the bed cafe, and up comes jealousy. Who are they talking to? Maybe they're having a secret relationship. Maybe they're not telling me something. Where's that come from?
Fear.
Yeah, fear. Exactly. It comes from neediness. It comes from our fears. It comes from our survival mind. Ego. It comes from the ego. And the ego is interfering with our love. And a love at that time is limited by ego. There's a point where we need to say, that's the edge of my love. That's the limit of my love. The ego comes in and makes a boundary on my love. I need to look at that really carefully. And at that point, see deeply the working of my ego, how it arises, how it is for me, the pain that it gives, the pain that it gives to me and to the other person. And that, by seeing that, by being aware, not guilty, but just awareness of the way, the pain of it, it begins to melt. We take responsibility for it, and it melts. And that's the way love grows, when we see resistance. Just like when we walk, we need resistance on the floor. If there's no resistance, we wouldn't walk. So love grows through resistance, through seeing the limit of love. One of the places we grow love is there, by all the time seeing how we limit our love and letting that go. And all these movements of jealousy, of self, of neediness, of loneliness, of doubt, of resistance, of confusions, of fears, are all places where love is limited and where love has resistance. And we need to go to that place. And in the mythology, it's really interesting. The mythology has got a nice way of describing this. In myths, the adventurer, the person going exploring, meets this very ugly person, right? Ugly witch, ugly man, ugly dwarf, or ugly old
a frog,
or ugly old woman. You have to kiss the frog, and then you realize it's a prince or princess. You have to kiss the old woman, then you realize, then the old woman turns into a princess. Because the old woman never was, is always a princess. But we didn't see the princess in the old woman until we kiss, until we overcome our barrier to love, our resistance, our egos, our conditioning that says she's a witch, she's a frog, she's a monster, she's a dwarf. So another place that we need to kind of practice here is to be very, very close and familiar and okay with all the feelings that arise. To be really, really in tune with the life of our heart. Because the life of our heart is expressing love, but in many different languages. It's got many different languages. So the life of the heart will say this, will say that. I'm happy, not happy, I'm joy, I'm miserable, sadness, compassion, interest, enthusiasm, attention, boredom, etc. All of that is the heart talking. When we begin to see the heart talking as much as the mind talking, then the both of them will help. Both of them will be in a way released. So instead of kind of saying, oh, I'm bored, I need entertainment, I must go on a holiday. It's what is really the heart telling me now? I'm with you, my feeling life. This is the music of the moment. A lot of practice, metta practice, is about this. That when I teach metta, and we have a retreat, by the way, this year, every year, 1 week retreat with Simi, myself. And we teach metta, but when we teach the phrases, we do teach, I'll mention this in a minute, the phrases, but the phrases are there in order to awaken interest in what the heart is saying. The phrases are not about shtifat moach. So we have to kind of go through life with these phrases, like on our fridge, yeah, every morning. So it's not a bad thing to have for these phrases, may you be happy and may you be peaceful, and they're fine, they're really, it's a good way to start the day, it's fine, no problem, but they are there as triggers to trigger our ability to listen to what the heart is telling us. And when we listen, we don't always like it, because we can't control the heart. So the heart can tell us, "Ani mutzban, ma'od, mashu lo oved po." That's what the heart can tell. We say, "Oh, shut up! I don't want to know. Shut up!" But actually, what we should say is, "Okay, I listen. I'm listening. I hear you. I'm with you. I'm there for you. The heart is telling me something. It's about the world. I don't have a problem with you telling me atzpanut. Let's just look at it together, be with it together. My heart and myself, my heart and mind. It's okay." What helps us with all of this to listen to the language of the heart, and this is basic dharma, and you've probably all been told this many, many times in most retreats, that there isn't such a thing as a neutral experience. There isn't such a thing as an experience that is utterly dry, that has no heart in it at all. So we may think, well, a thought like an idea, mustam, mani ochel arachat erev ayom, and it's lo stamet bichlal. Yes, you know, in that thought, interest. In that thought is something driving interest in supper. Or, you know, it's hard, I can't even think of a thought that is stam, because I don't know any thought that's just stam. Every single thought has in it even a little bit, even an interest, what's interesting to us. So I look at this bell because I need it. That interest already has heart in it. Something is moving me, the whole of me, to the bell and to pay attention to it. Paying attention is already the heart. The heart is already paying attention to something. So in other words, it's got to be in everything, the heart. It's and neurology knows this. There isn't any thought without heart. Some heart, some affect, called affect. So I just want to say a few, couple of words about metta. And as Christopher points out in his article that I sent you, it's a method. Metta bhavana, developing metta, is a method. And it's not in the ancient Buddhist tradition. It's in a Buddhist tradition which is medieval, Visuddhimagga, which is extremely, extremely detailed, a guidebook or handbook of huge amount of methods and systems of practice. So the traditional Buddhism is why we don't really go according to the Visuddhimagga in most of the teaching of Dharma today in the West doesn't go there. There's some teachers that still teach it, but it's too much. And here is an example. It takes a method and defines it. It's very technical in a way. So metta bhavana is a ritual, just like I said before, rituals to create love, that allow love to happen. So metta is one of those. Metta bhavana is a useful practice. Bhavana is cultivation. Cultivation actually is even that, you can see in the word cultivation, bhavana, cultivation, it tells you something, because love can't be cultivated. Love is everywhere, love is everything. You can't cultivate love. You could, well, everything we're talking about is removing the blocks to love. But metta does do that. So the way metta is developed is wise. It's a good way, it's a good practice, but you have to understand its limits. It is not creating itself Brahma Vihara. It is a wise practice, like I was saying before, also insight is a wise practice. Seeing is wise, and metta bhavana is wise to practice overcoming resistance. And it's practiced by the phrases, and it's practiced by making it clear what is our love, opening the heart to people close to us, and then a bit further, and then to strangers. So it does open the field, and tends to move love, open love beyond conditions. So it's helpful practice, but it's, I think, one of the rituals of releasing love, and there are many of them. And so it's helpful, but it's not the same as something universal. I think we have to agree with Christopher, to stay with this bigness, the bigness of love. as bracha. Metta is like bracha, it's brachot. So in a way you can say brachot, everything is bracha. And it's right. And you can feel like, say that, and see it. And metta is practice of giving brachot in a way. So, I want to move to the side of sexual relations. And I sent you Thich Nhat Hanh. He writes about sex in the framework of one of the precepts, and then he develops it. And of course, it's totally mixed with love, and it's part of love. It's one of the fields of love, and because sexuality is such a big power, it needs a lot of respect. And a lot of recognition, and it also is directed by rituals, by triggers, like my story of this perfume at the age of 18. It needs to be given a lot of respect. Because of its power. And it's where love engages the body. Where the body and the hormones and all the energies of the body is kind of empowered by love. And the body can be more or less with the heart in this, in sexuality. Can be more body or less body, can be more body or more heart. And it depends on the situation. And basically, for householders, the Buddha didn't have a problem with sexual life, and didn't talk about it that much for householders. And it wasn't an issue. And the Dharma basically is not against sexual life, except for monks. And in many ways, the Dharma would actually encourage sexual life, healthy sexual life, because it brings joy and it brings harmony. And for householders. However, there's many views in this whole issue. And someone once asked me, what do I think about sex, one night stands, you call it in English? I don't know how Hebrew.
Stutz.
What do I think about that? And Thich Nhat Hanh doesn't like the idea. And his voice, I think, personally, I don't quite agree with his voice there. And the reason is that sex is also joy. And sex, the most important issue is that there needs to be union with two people who are not abused by each other, who are not using each other. The issue of sex is that because the body is so involved and desire is so involved, it's really, you're lost in a way, and you get taken over, and then you don't see the other person. Even though sex is union, so you should really be one with the other person, and that includes total seeing. As in the Bible, sex and knowing is the same word. So, but the desire is so strong that sometimes it's just, you're just consumed by your own desire, and that's where it can lead to issues. So my view would be, there isn't any conditions for sexuality to express itself You don't need to say it must be in long-term relationship or not long-term relationship. I don't think you need principles here. I think you need seeing. It would be my own view. That if your needs are somehow pressuring another person, or, for example, the other person is just making the other person more lonely because of this one-night sex, and the other person is left more lonely, more isolated, more lost. It's up to you to see that and to make sure that that doesn't happen. So you do not do that because you see that it's the wrong reason or the wrong situation. But seeing has to be the basis, not some principle of controlling sexual activity through. It's a bit conservative for me, in my view. And I feel that the love, if however much love is there, is wonderful. But if two people come together for a night because they both feel absolutely right with it, and it's what it is, and in the morning they say goodbye, I don't feel there's a problem with that personally. I mean, you can argue with me, but personally I don't feel there's a problem. But you have to be very, very aware of abuse, because it can get very, it's very, very delicate, this place. And you have to be very aware and very sensitive and very listening, and what feels right and feels in harmony, that's what guides you, that you don't abuse each other. And the monks were celibate because the huge energy is needed, of sexuality is needed. The monks use every bit of energy, the heart energy, the mind energy, the body energy. And the body energy of sexuality is so powerful that the monks need it and use it for devotion and for empowering practice. An energizing practice, so that's why celibacy is for monks who are totally committed. They're married to their practice. That's the marriage. But still, I can say from talking to many monks and so on, and being in connection with many monks, that for some people it's a nightmare. For some young monks in the monasteries, it's a nightmare. This whole thing. Of sexuality. They just never quite cope with it, they're always busy with it, they're always thinking, you know, it's just a hard one. And many monks leave after a while because they fall in love, like Christopher. Mm-hmm. And others too. They realize that love is such a strong power that they want to go with it and leave the monastery. And many, many monks do that. There is a whole world which I don't want to go into. It's not that I'm not the big expert on it, although I know a little bit about it, of using sexuality for spiritual awakening. And that's in the world of Tantra, in the world of all kinds of practices, in which sexuality is used as a power of dissolving the self and inviting universal awareness to, in a way, it's huge power. And sexuality is in yogic tantra, in Buddhist tantra, in Chinese tantra, Chinese practices, spirituality, this is a kind of a dangerous path, because it's using desire to go beyond the ego or the self. And this desire is so powerful that it's a dangerous path. It's like jumping on a galloping horse, like fast car, and you could kind of jump off, fall off, get yourself hurt. So it is part of spiritual life, but it's a risk. And so finally, it's all right to it's all right, I think, to really see the way sexual life in us is moving, the channels. I think to be in touch with our sexuality is really important. Not to be frightened of it, not to be busy with it, not to be suppressing it. It's okay to channel it somewhere. If it happens to be channeled into paths which are helpful, it's really okay. Suppressing it gives pain. You have to know that, to see that as well. I think just to be familiar with it, to be a kind of friend of the sexual energy and not a and not an enemy of it, and not trying to control it, and not trying to plug it, and so on. But and it might not be in balance all the time, but it doesn't really matter so much. Things are not necessarily going to be in balance. You can't ask everything to be in balance. Some things are out of balance, let it be out of balance. But just to know that it's a bit out of balance, it's okay. And all the time, allowing sexuality to flower as intimacy. And really enjoying the way sexuality flowers as intimacy. And intimacy is something big. Intimacy is love. So allowing sexuality to keep bringing you to this place of intimacy, of love, and it opens the doors to a bigger love. And in that sense, sexuality is really something, a blessing for us, and a joy, and something beautiful. And I don't think we need to be frightened of it in the name of spirituality, or in the name of Dharma. Providing, as I say, we are watchful of this power. And a final word, that to be responsible. Responsibility is part of this. Thank you.